Edith about him to me. We've each been rather cautious in what we've said about him to the other. Now, her children have asked me all kinds of things about him.
This is tape number 19, side one of the Edward F. Pritchard interviews, August 2nd,
1983.
You want to talk about Catherine Grant?
No, not that. Okay. I mean, I could talk a lot about her, but I don't know if we'll get to it.
Today I'd like to talk very much about Henry Ward at the end of the Brett administration. How it came that Henry Ward was the administration candidate.
Well, I think Henry Ward was the administration candidate simply because nobody appeared to be quite the combination of a capable administrator and one who really had political strength that he had. Henry Ward really, it struck me, was the only candidate that was seriously considered once Judge Combs went on the bench. Now, I think everybody's preference in the political circles would have been Judge Combs. But Judge Combs went on the bench just about the time the primary shaped up. And I think the refusal of Judge Combs to make the race, his preference for the bench, really left no serious alternative. As I look back, you know, you already had candidates, Hawson to run, Chandler, Waterfield. I believe David Trapp got in that race.
Yes,
well, hell, all that made Henry a cinch to win the primary. You know, if he couldn't have won that primary, he shouldn't have been a constable. All that split opposition. And Henry had the respect of the business community. He had the respect of the press, which always sort of idolized him. He had the respect of the general public. He alienated some of the people in the political groups, but a lot of them liked him. A lot of them got along with him, you know. Henry had an unfortunate habit of doing something for you and making you mad at the same time. He really, you know, other than exercising a certain amount of caution and restraint in what he gave away to the local politicians, Henry was not, in a political sense, just hard to get along with. He might cuss you, and he would tell you how much he knew, but Henry was acknowledged by everybody to be a very capable administrator. He had run the highway program pretty well. I think he was constantly in some tension with Judge Combs and Governor Combs and Governor Breathitt about what he regarded as excessive expenditures on certain highways that he thought were politically all right, but probably weren't worth the money they cost. But he was enough of a regular to go along, and I heard one politician say, you know, Henry made more fights to get his employees and engineers better salaries than any highway commissioner that I ever knew. And yet he'd get in the elevator with them and wouldn't speak to them. And they'd get half mad at him, even though he'd fight for them to get raises. Now, that wasn't altogether true. Henry had some of the engineers and administrators over there that just swore by him. But Henry Ward, he did, in my judgment, a really outstanding job in that highway department. And after all, that was then the biggest element in state government. We did not, you know, we were just beginning then to have this big social program. You know, they really didn't come in full bloom till the very late 60s and the 70s, although they were on the books, some of them. And, you know, Department of Human Resources didn't exist then. You had the Health Department and you had the Economic Security Department. It was more the old-fashioned structure. So the Highway Department was the backbone of state government, and Henry was able to get financial support in his campaign. A lot of business people contributed to him. Of course, some of the contractors and engineers contributed, as they always do, to the incumbent. And it was a little easier to finance a campaign for Henry, I guess, than it would have been for somebody that was more of an outsider. And the only defect that he really had was a defective personality, which never bothered me because I got along with him fine. You know, he was, and I think a lot of people in the political process got along with him fine. But he could, you know, I can remember once he attended a big labor rally. They always had at Pikeville, you know, in September on Labor Day, I guess. Always had a great big crowd, and Henry got up to speak to him. He says, you know, said, I'm glad to have your endorsement, but said, I don't think these labor endorsements mean as much as they used to. You know, he'd say things like that. Or he would...
What do you attribute that to? Just ignorance in politics or just frankness?
I think it was partly frankness that he couldn't suppress. And partly it was a kind of ego trip that just, he's a little fella, you know. He'd sit in that big chair in the highway department and his feet would barely meet the floor. And I think two things bugged his ego. One was that he was short and ugly, you know, kind of had pock marks. And the other was that he'd never had a college education. And I think those two things made him have a sensitive ego, and the sensitivity was shown by the way he would be abrasive.
Was he a reluctant candidate?
No. He wanted to run. I think, really, he would have been willing to run when Breathitt ran. But he took that in good grace and loyally supported Breathitt. And I think Breathitt appreciated that. But I really think and Breathitt probably had more impact than anybody on it. He was the incumbent governor. I think what really influenced him above all was his feeling that he couldn't think of anybody that would have made a better governor than Henry. And I really believe that that's probably true.
What were some of the issues in that primary?
Oh, I don't know if there were any issues. Chandler was running. At that point, you know, he got Kenton and some of them to kind of be his brain trust, and they dressed him up a little bit, as I recall it. got him talking about a few good government issues, which of course contrasted dramatically with his performance in office. Henry Ward had, as usual, a kind of a grouchy campaign. You know, Harry Lee Waterfield. Harry Lee was kind of a grouch. And I guess Henry talked mainly about being tight-fisted and about being a good manager of the state's affairs, and ran to a certain degree on the record of the Combs Breathitt performance, like the Mountain Parkway and the roads they built and the universities and the educational program. But I think if Henry had been elected, he would have been much, much more of a penny pincher than Combs and Breathitt were.
Well, of course, Ward won that primary. Was it a very large
vote? Yes. And that probably is what caused him to get beat in the fall. I expect he got pretty near as many votes, maybe as many as Harry Lee and Happy put together. He got a huge, huge majority of plurality in the primary. And in a way, why wouldn't he? He had a well-financed campaign. Happy and Harry Lee didn't have anything much. He had a state organization for him. And yet I think he convinced himself that he won that primary because he was the darling of the people and because he was just recognized as the ablest fellow in the state to be governor. And although this latter may have been true, I think it gave him a certain arrogance for the fall. And he never really went out and courted the opposition. He never went out and courted the local politicians. And I think Chandler bolted and Harry Lee about halfway bolted and their people just laid down on it. And then in the course of the campaign, early, they had the annual, is it a luncheon or breakfast, of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce at the state fair. All right, and usually the candidates debated each other at that thing, and Harry Lee and Louis Nunn and Henry Ward debated, and Henry Ward knocked him out of the ring. The unanimous consensus of everybody that was there, business people, politicians, everybody else, was that Henry had just knocked him out of the ring. Louis emerged from the primary scarred. He had had that nasty race with Marlo Cook in which religious prejudice played probably the decisive part. You know, Tim Lee Carter had spoken very scathingly of him after the primary. Others did. The Courier Journal had run stories about the efforts to stir up bigotry. And it looked like Henry was a cinch and Louis was a dead cat. But two things happened. Henry just took it for granted that he was the victor and began to get more arrogant and more stiffer. And Louis went out and just used every stratagem he could to pick up every dissident that he could, and they did a very skillful job of mobilizing the sore toes of the little local politicians whom Henry had not made much effort to appease after the primary, the ones that had opposed him. Well, Louis also did a good job of knitting up the raveled sweater of Republican unity, at least to the point of getting Cook and Calga to go down the line for him in Jefferson County, and Dr. Carter to go down the line for him in the 5th District. And he presented a rather united front. And then he seized on an issue that proved pretty good. He found a study that some graduate school in Missouri or someplace had done about the rankings of the various states in economic development and education and all these other things, and it ranked Kentucky very low. And Lewis started hammering toward the end of the campaign on the proposition that after whatever it was, 16 years of uninterrupted Democratic rule, Kentucky ranked at the bottom in everything. And he did a right effective job with that. I mean, I think that probably helped him with what you might call the independent voters and some of the distant Democrats. And Henry sat on his butt and didn't do much in the last month or two of the campaign. After he had him knocked out, then was the time I begged Henry. I helped in that campaign. I didn't stay down there the way I had in some others, but I'd go down and spend a day or two, or a day and a night, or 2 days and a night. And I kept begging him. I said, you got him down. Don't let him up. Don't let him up. Just make his name an indecency, because the people are ready for that. And, you know, he was reluctant to do it. He thought he's a cinch to win, and he wanted to maintain his dignity as a gubernatorial governor. And the consequence was that with the dissidents in the Democratic Party and with Louis' pretty good kind of a negative campaign and the unity that Louis managed to put together in the Republican Party, none beat him, about 30,000, 35,000. Now, that was it. And, you know, it was a particularly a bit of pill for Henry to swallow when the lieutenant governor was elected, Wendell Ford. And while there were some people that, you know, there was some, that's another thing none skillfully did, you know. In places where the Democrats were strong, they put out a little talk. And even had some non-Ford stickers printed, automobile bumper stickers. Now, I never thought that Ford had anything to do with that, or that it was really an organized thing among Democrats. But I think it, that none skillfully played on it. And as you recall, most of the Democrats on the ticket were elected. Wendell was elected. John Breckinridge was elected. Wendell Butler was elected. Thelma Stovall was elected. That's right. The only Republicans that won were Louis Nunn and the auditor, who was Clyde Conley.
And
what?
Dick Vermegan, clerk of court of appeals.
And, yes, and the commissioner of agriculture. I forget his name now. He was from down in Monroe County. I forget his name. Pretty nice little fella. That's right. Now, they won. But still, it's remarkable that when the gubernatorial candidate wins by 35,000 votes, that the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, treasurer, and a commissioner of agriculture on the opposite ticket are elected. It indicates to me that it was a sort of personal thing for Henry, against Henry.
Well, I think they played a great deal in the campaign, too, on Henry's arrogance.
Well, of course.
I mean, they just cannot say he was arrogant, but some of Henry's actions. Well, his actions were such that
Henry himself wouldn't deny he was arrogant, I don't think. Henry was kind of proud of it.
Well, how did he take the defeat?
He took it all right. He just figured he was out of politics. He took the... Did he first go over to Paducah with the paper or to the Chamber of Commerce?
Not the
Chamber. No, I'm not sure about that. I can't remember. He had been with the Chamber back when Chandler was... after Clements was beat, I thought, maybe. And then he went to, he worked in Clements' office in Washington after Chandler was elected until Clements got beat. Then I guess he did work for the Chamber, but then he went to Paducah and then came back to the Chamber. He fell out with the Paxtons. He went over there and, as editor and publisher of the Sun Democrat, and that didn't last very long. He went back to the Chamber of Commerce. No, or the independent colleges. That's what he went to after the Chamber, the Sun Democrat. He went to be head of the organization that was to raise money and promote the so-called independent colleges, the private colleges.
Well, during the campaign, who were some of his key advisors?
Well, Foster Ackerman was his chairman. You can't fault that, because Foster was Breathitt's chairman and was the best I ever saw. Ed Farris was one of his key advisors. Bob Matthews, which probably wasn't all that much force. I would say those people.
You mentioned Bob Bell.
Bob Bell, that's right. Of course, Bob was in the highway department. Or Bob may have been over and seeing Parks of Revenue by then. He had been Phil Swift. Henry managed his own campaign. That was one of his troubles.
What was the impact of Nunn's victory on the Democratic Party?
Well, in a way,
what changes can you attribute to Nunn's victory to the Democratic Party?
What
changes in the Democratic Party can you attribute to Nunn's victory? Any at all?
Not much. Oh, I can attribute the rise of J.R. Miller and Wendell Ford to the election. That was the main thing, and it was pretty important. I think the Democrats were shattered at first. They were broke. They had little old headquarters down there on East Main. Old money, had a deficit. Party felt shattered. First time they'd been out of power in 20 years, or first election they'd lost in 20 years. And the legislature was, I don't know what you want to call it, in disarray. And they were... The legislative numbers were close enough to where Louis, with certain skill, was able to pick up enough Democrats to prevail. Republicans had much better discipline than the Democrats, because some of the Democrats that played with Louis got patronage, that kind of thing. Where's my matches?
There you go.
Got it. You take, for instance, the 2% addition to the sales tax. The Democrats, of course, Louis, in the first place, had a good issue. Because, you know, right after the November election, Breathitt revealed the existence of a shortage of funds. That was a time when we had a credit crunch in 66 with the Vietnam War. Interest rates went up. It was some ways similar to this condition, except not as severe. Receipts went down. The crunch was in 66, but as usually happens, the fiscal consequences were a year later. So we had a shortfall of revenue in 1967. Breathitt, after the election, issued an order impounding sufficient funds to balance the budget for the remainder of the fiscal year, including some educational funds and others. This made it much easier for none to get by with an increase in taxation, because he tried to justify it on the grounds that the Democrats had left the cupboard bare and that he had no choice, and that his commitments not to increase taxes were made in the light of information he didn't have. Well, of course, if he'd had people around him in his campaign, like Foggy, who helped him some, but wasn't that close then. Foggy was then working in Washington, I believe, for Cooper. But anyway, if he'd had people like that, they could have told him.
Would that have made any difference in what he said?
Oh, I don't know whether it would have made any difference or not, but it would have, he couldn't have had it as an excuse, I guess, as easily as if he... But it doesn't make any difference. I mean, you know, the shortfall didn't accumulate just in the month after the election. So, regardless of that, it made it easier for Louis to advocate a tax increase and give a Democrat some reason to go along with it.
What about the Nunn administration?
Wait a minute. Let me finish with the taxes.
Uh-huh.
In addition, Nunn used the raw power of patronage to buy enough legislators to pick up a scant majority. Let's face it, Nunn had run on a promise to get Bill May out of Frankfort. Like most every governor that wasn't on the inside, he ran on a platform, let's get rid of Bill May. Of course, Breathitt had let contracts during the year of the campaign to May and others for the engineering work on the Dannebrog Parkway and the Cumberland Parkway, which were of doubtful fiscal merit. Not the contracts, but the roads. And one would have thought that if the state was in that bad a shape, that an incoming governor would have stop those new roads, which, as you know, were denominated toll roads, but actually were paid out of tax money. But instead, Louis, through Harold Kelly, who had been Louis's roommate or something in law school, made a deal with Bill May that if Bill would deliver him some votes in the Senate, he would go ahead with these roads. and give the contracts to May, who already had them tentatively. And I'll tell you, he delivered the votes. He delivered the vote of Lawrence Weatherby. He delivered the vote of his cousin, C.B. Latta. He delivered the vote of, what was his name, Pearl Strong, one of the Strongs from up at Hazard. He delivered several votes in the Senate. And Bill May got more business from Louis Nunn's administration than he got from Chandler, Combs, Breathitt, all added up. Now, what was your next question?
What is the chief contribution made by the Nunn administration?
Well, I think probably the chief contribution was what he did that I'm denouncing. That is, he went ahead and put the extra taxation on, or got it through, and that kept the state government solvent and enabled certain things to be done. Education. Nunn built that mental retardation facility down near Somerset. He built a lot of roads. You know, they weren't all needed, but he built them. He kind of did the same things in overall policy that Democratic governors had been doing. More taxes, more money, more programs for education, more programs for mental health. More programs for highways. It was a very corrupt administration. Of course, one of the worst things they did was to try to gut the State Personnel Act. And that was one of the things that put me into collision course with him. I represented a lot of the employees that he fired. And on behalf of a lot of others, I filed a class action, which was ultimately at least partially successful and was finally settled during the following administration after Judge Meigs had entered a judgment in our favor.
That was a rather sizable judgment.
Mm-hmm. Or it could have been a whole lot bigger. But I guess the employees and I both wanted a hand, bird in the bush, bird in the hand. Judge Meigs didn't allow us all we should have had. And the truth is that if I had really had my wits totally about me, I could have filed a second class action based on a group of mass firings the following May or June. And I was, I was so busy with this one that I never got around to filing that one. The basis of my class action was that they had fired these employees en masse and had cited no specific charges against them, just said political activity. Judge Cullen had held in one of the cases involving an individual employee. He said it wasn't necessary. They argued, that you had to go before the personnel board and couldn't go directly to court. And Judge Cullen, in this opinion, said that where the dismissals were just void on their face, and didn't state any basis, even on the face of it, for firing them or anything specific, then they could go to court directly and bypass the personnel board. And that's when I filed my class action, when I saw, because that was my case Cullen wrote the opinion in. But you know, there was a second bunch of firings, a very large bunch, in about May, I believe it was, or June of 1968, where they simply cited the statute. Certain sections of the statute, but didn't cite any names, any dates, any specific conduct. And really, I had a good class action there too, and never did perfect it. I guess I just had my hands full. But anyway, that was the way it went.
Well,
now, of course, he did other things. He assessed the employees in the most vicious way. He had his people from the governor's office and the highway department going out time after time and collecting huge sums in cash. And nobody knew where they went. He had people in his office like Murphy. And that boy killed himself. And a couple of them were in the highway department. I had affidavits on it all.
It was during his administration that the Rita Beard, is that her name, with ITT, and there's some kind of uproar that he was connected with. No, she was here on Derby Day.
Well.
Or was she the one that was supposed to have brought down $100,000 for the Embassy campaign? Or am I totally off base?
Well, you are not totally off base. But none of this was revealed, I don't believe, until the Watergate came out in 73. I think the facts were that she was down here for the Derby, maybe when John Mitchell was here, and that she was supposed to have passed out drunk on the floor of the mansion drawing room. And that her purpose in being here was supposed to have been to bring a pile of money for Embleton's campaign. And that was all revealed, at least a good part of it, I believe, in the Watergate hearings. Or was it in the IT&T hearings? Because she worked for IT&T.
I think IT&T.
That's right. That was, but the IT&T hearings were in 73, too. That was Harold Janine. And by the way, do you know who represented IT&T during the course of all those things?
No.
Felix Royton.
Is that right?
Not as a lawyer, but as a banker. And he was greatly embarrassed by those, although they did not reflect anything particularly on him personally, except that he was connected with IT&T as their banker.
Well, Nunn's election, according to some people, really began the General Assembly on kind of a reform road in terms of its structure and its procedures. And these same people would say has led to a more independent thinking legislature.
Independent, I won't say thinking.
Do you have any assessment of that?
Oh, I think the tension between the Democratic legislature and the Republican governor, and the Democratic lieutenant governor and the Republican governor, obviously led to some of that. I never thought they were very effective during Nunn's administration. They talked about it, and I think the only thing I can remember now that they really accomplished, of course, the LRC, perforce, became a more independent agency because the governor didn't control it. And that was the way Ford had his staff. It was very helpful to him politically. Then the other thing that happened during that was the Legislative Audit Committee, which I think was the beginning of some effort to keep tabs on the executive branch with regard to finances and expenditures. And don't you, am I not right that that's when you first had a legislative auditor?
That's correct.
And I think that tended to build some independence. I think that, yes, I think the friction between Nunn and the legislature probably did two things. It made Ford the strong candidate that he was in 1971, and it began to sow the seed of more legislative independence. I don't know of very many things on which the legislature actually demonstrated independence when push came to shove during the Nunn administration. He got his budget fair. I think they may have modified his budget a little bit, which was the first time they'd done that. But they didn't modify it in a serious way. But it laid the groundwork. There's no question about it. And it bore fruit ultimately. But there were a whole lot of twists and turns before it did. I think that the emergence of Ford was obviously attributable to his being the, you know, sort of titular head of the party during that administration. And the fact that his friend Miller was chairman of the Democratic Party. In fact, Breathitt chose Miller. You know, when you had the Democratic Party reorganization in 1968, well, the truth is, Miller was made chairman before that. I'm trying to think who was chairman. Shelby Kincaid was chairman during that primary in 71. See, J.R. resigned. But right after the election in 67, who was it? Ackerman resigned, I believe. And so Breathitt, who controlled the committee, had us to put Miller in as chairman. And the party was broke. I've gone through that a little bit earlier, but the party was broke. They had that little old headquarters down on Main Street. And Miller took charge. And he was picked by Breathitt. And Miller was the best organizer that was ever party chairman that I know of. He made bricks without straw. He raised enough money by hook and by crook to keep the party organization going barely on a frugal basis. He financed legislative campaigns for 1969, enough to keep us in good shape and win some victories. We started electing officials in Jefferson County again in 1969. It was that's when the turnaround occurred. Part of it was anti-Nunn. Part of it was a resurgence of Democratic organization and vigor. It was not issue-oriented to any great extent. There were a few things. Terry McBrayer introduced somewhere along that line the first Consumer Protection Bill, did it not?
I believe it's correct.
There were some things like that that came along. The Young Democrats under the presidency of Don Mills, became resurgent and energetic. It was the beginning of a period of almost uninterrupted democratic domination in this state that has lasted pretty much to the present time. And of course, both partly the creator and partly the beneficiary of it was Wendell Ford.
Had Miller been on the scene, state scene, for a long time, or I'm a little foggy on his history, or did he come up with Ford and Carroll?
No.
Carroll was also a protege of his, was he not?
Mm-hmm. Mellows. Emergence goes back to Clements' time. When Clements was governor, his organization in Davis County was basically Clyde Watson, that's Bobby Watson's daddy, and J.R. Miller. That's when I first got to know J.R. Of course, J.R. was the head of the Green River Electric Co-op, and it was his fondest wish to go into generating and transmission business. Clements' Public Service Commission gave them their first certificate of authority, and that's the first time that a rural co-op in Kentucky went into G&T business. At that time, he was very close to Clements, and I think probably continued to be. You see, in 1965, you know, Cap Gardner had been the floor leader in the 64 session and had infuriated Breathitt, Miller, and all of them by being a disloyalist and following a kind of Waterfield heresy that I mentioned before. And the thing was to beat Cap Gardner. And so in order to do that, they picked J.R. and Clyde picked Wendell Ford. His father had been a longtime politician over there. He'd been state senator. Never was highly respected. He's considered kind of a sleazy politician. My father always told me you could get him for $100. Didn't have $100, you'd get him for $50. You didn't have $50, you'd get him for $25. You didn't have $25, you could get him for a ham or a shoulder or a side of bacon. But anyway, Wendell was always anxious to clean up that image and did to some degree. Not sure it lasted, but anyway, Breathitt went all, you see, Wendell Ford had been Breathitt's chairman in 1963 in Davis County, and had done a hell of a job. Breathitt carried the hell out of Davis County. And so, Breathitt put everything in the world he could into Ford's campaign, money, patronage, everything. And Ford only beat Gardner by about 100 votes. And I remember Catalou and I used to sit up nights making ads for Ford, for TV spots. I reckon they had TV then, but anyhow, for ads. And one of them is, there's a Ford in your future. And I can remember that just as well. And
that showed great originality. Would you say?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Wasn't it pretty obvious? But we used it. You know, usually things you use in a campaign are always obvious. But anyhow, Breathitt had some trouble with Ford. When Breathitt, I told you about the strip mine bill, didn't I? Well, Ford was one of those that didn't want to vote for it. And J.R. didn't want him to vote for it. Because, of course, you know, those power plants had a close tie with coal people. And Breathitt just twisted his arm and made him do it. In 66. After he'd gotten him elected in the Senate. In fact, it's a strange thing, but in that 66 session on the strip mine bill, most of the high-tight people voted wrong, like Dick Freimeyer and Sonny Hunt, who was considered a reformer then, and people like that. And the people that Breathitt got to pass the damn thing for him were John Raymond Turner, Billy Engle, Russell Reynolds, all the scallywags. But he did it by patronage. You can read all about that in a book on it by Mark Landy, which was published several years ago. But,
Is Mark still at Harvard?
No, he's at Boston College, got a tenured professorship. But anyway, that's the emergence of Ford, and that's the beginning of the resurgence of the Democratic Party.
During the Ford years as Lieutenant Governor, were you an advisor to him?
To him and J.R. both. In a moderate way, yes.
You remained on the executive committee of the party at that time?
Oh, certainly I did. I remained on it. I've been on it ever since. I've been on it for 24 years. Been on it since 1960. Yes, and I helped J.R. very much. Really, more J.R. than Wendell. Although I had close ties with Jim Fleming.
Oh.